Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lecture 4. Today, before I start the lecture, I want to go over one point that came up in one of the previous lectures, because I saw that it, on the quiz, but several people didn't get this right. It's an extremely important matter, so I wanted to devote some attention to it. But before I get to that, I just wanted to comment on one question in the quiz last week that some people missed. Is that I had a question. Remember, there was that kind of funny theory some people have, the origins of society, that society starts because people of the same race will hear the voice of the blood, and hearing the voice of the blood will get them all together, so that's why they form society. That isn't a theory you'd hear too much these days, but it has a rather fascist or Nazi affinities. But what Mises was writing and was active in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, it was a popular theory. So in one of the questions, I said, which one was not a criticism that Mises gave of the theory? Mises had a number of different criticisms, and which one was not a criticism he gave? And the question was, the one that was the right answer to that was that people don't generally have affinities or like people in their own ethnic group. Some people thought that was the right answer, that Mises had given that criticism. But he didn't, and that wouldn't be a good criticism, because it seems like it's not true that most people don't care anything about other people in their ethnic group. Probably a lot of people do, so that wouldn't have been a very good criticism. I just see Ryan said, I was confused in the question by the use of you. What were you referring to there? I'm not quite sure. But this wasn't, so this point on the, you have to, when you're reading a question, when you have a quiz, you should always ask yourself, would it make sense to attribute this particular criticism to Mises? That would have been a good thing to ask. Would it have been a good criticism of the theory that to saddle him with a statement that seems obviously false, that people don't have feelings for others in their ethnic group? And he doesn't say that a criticism, some people didn't think he did, but he did, was we don't have this feeling of the blood until society's already formed. He wasn't committed to saying we always, people do feel this, but he thought some people indeed do have that feeling, but it just comes up when society's already formed, so it's not an explanation of society. But that isn't the main thing I wanted to go over from the quiz. Is what I wanted, oh, this didn't work, just a sec here. Good, something actually worked that I did. Usually everything I touch doesn't work out. I wanted to deal with one concept we talked about, or dealing with law of association. Several people missed this on the quiz. I had several questions about comparative advantage. And it's extremely important that you understand this if you're planning to do further work in economics, because this is one of the most basic concepts. So I'm going to spend a bit of time on that. I think I didn't explain it very well. I spent too much time on how we know the law of association is true, and I didn't spend enough time on explaining exactly what the concept of comparative advantage is. And Ryan, I see now what you mean by you. When you, I was just using an example, like you imagine that you and I are trading, so you would just refer to one of any two people there. It doesn't have any particular significance other than that. So I want to review comparative advantage because I'm hoping when we go through this, it'll make it very clear, and then you'll never have any trouble with the concept again, and then you can explain it to me. And after you do that, you'll be qualified also to be referees in the Wenzel Kinsella IP debate. Did people listen to that one, incidentally? I thought it was a lot of fun. I don't know if any of you listened to that. It was on yesterday, I think. Okay, so suppose that you're better at growing apples than I am. We can both grow apples, but you're better at it. So then you have an absolute advantage over me in growing apples. I think that's pretty straightforward. If one person is better than somebody else in some kind of productive activity, then the one who's better has an absolute advantage. So that's the easy part. Everybody should get that. Now we get on to the part that's perhaps a little more difficult and could get people into trouble. Now, suppose further that both you and I want apples. We both want apples. And that we also want oranges. So I want apples, you want apples, I want oranges, you want oranges. And each of us can grow oranges as well as apples. By as well, I mean in addition to, not at the same level of skill as. So each of us can grow apples and oranges, but you have an absolute advantage over me in growing apples. You're better than I am in growing apples. Now, what should we do in that situation? Remember what the situation is. Each of us can grow apples and oranges, and we both want to end up with some combination of apples and oranges, but you have an absolute advantage over me in growing apples. So the question is, what should we do? Should we each grow apples and oranges ourselves, or should we specialize in one of these and trade for the other? And we can use the concept of comparative advantage to give us the answer to this. So comparative advantage will tell us what should we do in this situation. Again, each of us wants apples and oranges, so what should we do? Should we produce, how much of each should we produce for ourselves? How much should we trade with the other person? So comparative advantage is dealing with the question, which of two goods that I can either produce for myself or trade to get should I produce, and which one should I obtain and trade? So you see, comparative advantage then is addressing a different question from absolute advantage. Absolute advantage is addressing the question, who is better at doing something than the other person? Who is a better producer of something? And comparative advantage is, what should each person produce, or what should each person try to get in trade? So see, comparative advantage and absolute advantage are addressing other questions, different questions. Now, okay, so I went over this. I guess I must have somehow anticipated what was on the next slide. Since I wrote them, that's not as surprising as you might think. Okay, so as I say, absolute advantage is who can produce a good better comparing two traders, comparative advantage. Which of two goods should I produce? Which of two goods should you produce? Now, let's go back to our supposition. You're better than I am at growing apples, and we both want, and we both can grow both apples and oranges. Now, what happens if I'm better than you are in growing oranges? So you're better in growing apples, and I'm better in growing oranges. In this case, where you're better in growing apples and I'm better in growing oranges, and here, when I say better, I mean having an absolute advantage, that you're better in growing apples, you can grow apples better than I can, and I'm better in growing oranges, I can grow oranges better than you can. So we'd each be both better off if you specialize in growing apples, what you're best at, and I specialize in growing oranges. And why would we be better off if we do that than if we each try to produce both apples and oranges? Well, since each of us is growing what we're best at or better at, we'll have a greater total amount to divide. If each of us tried to produce apples and oranges, we wouldn't have as great a total. Since you're better at producing apples than I am, you'll produce more apples than I could in that time, and I'll produce more oranges than you could in the time, so we'll have a greater total amount. So in this case, you have a comparative advantage in growing apples, meaning of comparative advantages telling you which of the two goods you should produce, and I have a comparative advantage in growing oranges. That's the one I should produce. So here, comparative advantage and absolute advantage coincide because you're absolutely better than I am in growing apples, and I'm absolutely better in growing oranges, and you have a comparative advantage in growing apples, and I have a comparative advantage in growing oranges. That is to say, we'll both be better off if we specialize in what we each do best. So, does everybody get all that? Do we have any questions so far? Anybody have any difficulties with this part? Okay, good. Now we can get into the part that might be a bit confusing, or I think possibly confuse some people. Okay. What happens if you're better both at growing apples than I am and also better in growing oranges? That's likely to be the case in the real world, since I can't grow apples or oranges at all, but never mind that. Okay, so you're better at both, and you have an absolute advantage over me in growing both apples and oranges, because remember, absolute advantage means you're comparing two people and how they produce the same good. So if one is better than the other one, then that person has an absolute advantage. So you have an absolute advantage in both. You're better in producing both of them. But you don't have a comparative advantage in both, because remember, comparative advantage is dealing with the question, which goods should you produce? So the comparative advantage wouldn't, in this case, be determined by the absolute advantage. To find out what comparative advantage, we want to ask, where is the gap between us greater? Do you understand what gap am I talking about? Well, you're better at growing apples than I am. You're also better at growing oranges than I am. But how much better are you at growing apples, and how much better at growing oranges? So we could ask, where is the gap greater? Suppose you're much better than I am in growing apples and just a little better in growing oranges, then you have a comparative advantage in growing apples. So here, comparative advantage, in the situation where one person has an absolute advantage in both goods, then the one who has the absolute advantage has the comparative advantage where his superiority is the greater. So you then have an absolute and a comparative advantage in growing apples. You have an absolute advantage because you're better at growing apples than I am, and a comparative advantage because the degree to which you're better in growing apples than I am is greater than the degree to which you're better at growing oranges than I am. Now, maybe surprisingly, depending on how it strikes you, I have a comparative advantage in growing oranges. So even though I'm not as good as you are in growing oranges in this situation, I have a comparative advantage. You have the absolute advantage, but I have the comparative advantage. And why is that? Because even though I'm worse than you are, I'm not as worse as in growing apples. Now, to kind of sum all this up, there's one easy to remember sentence. I think if you can remember this, you'll be able to figure out most questions that you'll get on given the comparative advantage. Just ask you about the nature of the concept. I don't just mean in quizzes that I give, but when you have this in your future work in economics. This is what you remember. Comparative and absolute advantage can coincide, but they don't have to. This, I think, tripped up some people in the quiz. Some people thought, well, if someone has a comparative advantage, then you can't also have an absolute advantage, because they correctly realize, those people, that you can have a comparative advantage in something that you're not as good at producing as the other person. But the mistake is to think that has to be the case. It's you have a comparative advantage if you're superior in to a greater extent over the other person than you are with the other good, or you're less bad in producing the good than the other person. So either one of those two situations will apply, and that will give you your comparative advantage. Now, I hope I haven't muddied the waters further. So is everybody clear on all that, or do you have any further questions about it? Okay, good. So I put a few, I have on the quiz for this week, I put a couple questions on this just to make sure everybody can try out what you know on this. Now, I now want to go in to what were the subjects of the chapter, the pages we had today. And Mises makes a distinction between a worldview and an ideology. Sometimes people use those terms synonymously, but Mises draws a very sharp distinction between worldview and ideology. And as we'll see, this isn't just a matter of particular particular choice. He has certain words he likes, but this distinction plays a very important role in his thought. It's very important to him that he distinguishes between worldview and ideology. Now, by worldview, sometimes people use the German word Weltanschauung, is somebody has a question about comparative advantage here. Let me just see if I want to go into this. Now Phil asks a very interesting question. I was talking about comparative advantage where you just have two goods. Now he says, what about a multi-product case? You can basically solve that in the same way as with the two-product case, but it's much more difficult to work out the details. So I deliberately avoided going into that. So that would be something perhaps we could look at in more advanced courses or textbooks, but I deliberately avoided raising that. It's very perceptive of you to ask that question, but I deliberately avoided that because what I was trying to give is just the principle of comparative advantage. You can understand that from the two product case, but it's a little more difficult. And you ask at the end, will a producer always gain the most when he chooses to produce the product with which he has the greatest comparative advantage? Well, comparative advantage would be the one where your superiority is greatest. So it wouldn't be greatest comparative advantage. The comparative advantage is the one where the superiority is greatest, and that always would be your comparative advantage. But so basically, it's just applying the same principle to this more complicated case. But remember, I'll try to provide a reference on that. I mean, any standard book on international trade would deal with that. I think Leland Yeager has a good book on international trade where he would go into that in detail. Okay, so getting back to worldview. So worldview is a comprehensive doctrine about everything, trying to show that all knowledge is related. So you have a philosophy of life, or a religion could be a worldview. It's not everyone has a worldview, but some people do. It's kind of a comprehensive outlook on things. So a worldview isn't just a philosophy in the sense of a theory, but it also tells you what the nature of the world is like. Like suppose somebody says, well, I'm a philosophical materialist. I believe that there's nothing in the world beyond matter and motion. Some people hold such a view. So that wouldn't by itself be a worldview because it would just be a view about how the world is constituted. To get to a worldview, you'd have to also include opinions about what people should do. Say Marxism would be a worldview because it has this view, the materialist view. It says the world is composed of nothing but matter and motion, but then it has also very detailed ideas on what people should do. So that makes it a worldview, where straightforward materialism wouldn't be. Now, an ideology, as Mises uses the term, deals only with action. It would be saying, what should we do? So a worldview would include an ideology in it because the worldview tells you what you should do, but it also includes comprehensive view of the world, and then what you should do. But the ideology is dealing only with action. So the worldview includes an ideology, but notice it doesn't follow that every ideology has to have a worldview attached to it. You could have views about what to do that don't have some kind of comprehensive doctrine about the world associated with it. Say, Mises' own classical liberalism would be such an ideology. He has a view about how people should act if they want to attain prosperity, but he isn't providing any kind of detailed account of metaphysics, what the nature of being or how we know the world. He has sometimes remarks to make about metaphysical and epistemological problems, but he doesn't have a comprehensive view of the world, at least not one that he presents in Human Action. I don't think he did in other works either. Now, we know people have radically different worldviews. For example, some people are religious, some are atheists. Say when we saw a couple of weeks ago, there was a new pope who was just elected. This is some people, say there are over a billion people who will be very concerned with that. This is that would be their religious leader. Other people who aren't participants in that religion wouldn't have the same view of the pope as the ones who were Catholic. And we're not dealing only with religion, but there are all sorts, say, of views that aren't religious. There are all different kinds of worldviews. I mean, some people are Marxists, some are not Marxists. They're all different sorts of comprehensive doctrines about the world that you can study in philosophy courses or courses in history. Mises takes a rather skeptical view about how we could find out, if at all, which of these worldviews is true, or which ones are true if more than one could be true at the same time. Mises thinks it isn't possible to settle disputes about the transcendent. What do you mean by the transcendent? Well, what goes beyond the ordinary world that we live in? Say if you hold that the world is created by God or is the power of there's some kind of power, non-theistic notion of power that's moving the world. So Mises said, well, we can't really settle disputes about that. People have different opinions about this. But he seems, in this respect, he's somewhat like the people we very often consider his opponents, and rightly so, the logical positivists, that he takes a rather dim view of metaphysics. He thinks these are just idle speculations. We can't really know about how the nature of the world, other than as disclosed by science. We can't really settle disputes. If you say, for example, are the doctrines of Christianity true? Mises wouldn't really think that could be settled by in a way that would command rational assent from all reasonable people. So he said, well, people just have these different worldviews and they can't really settle disputes between them. But now we get to the crucial point. Why is Mises going into this point about worldviews? I mean, it may be true that people have different worldviews, but what does it have to do with economic theory? Why should he put this in a book on economics if people have different worldviews? And the reason is he wants to stress very much this doesn't, at this point, that people can't settle disputes about worldviews does not, repeat, not apply to ideology. Remember the difference between worldview and ideology. A worldview is a comprehensive doctrine about the nature of the world that also includes advice on what people should do, views on what people should do, but ideology is just a doctrine of what people should do. And his most important contention in these pages we have to consider is that disagreement about worldview doesn't prevent agreement about what actions to take, especially in economics. So Mises' key contention is going to be that, okay, you can have these different worldviews, people have different ideologies, but you'll still be able to come to agreement if you're reasonable about what actions to take. I see there's been apparently some kind of discussion going on here in the chat room between people. Somebody says, suggested practical, kind of jokingly, a practical argument for embracing Austrian ideas is that people who espouse them seem to live a very long time. I guess they're thinking of Mises, Hayek lived very long lives. But suppose that it just that suppose that's true, suppose there is a correlation, wouldn't follow that if you embrace Austrian economics, you will live a long time. It doesn't follow that it has a counterfactual. Of course, it would be like an example like this. Supposing in basketball playoff games, a team that loses the first game by 20 more points will tend to win the playoff. So it wouldn't be, it wouldn't follow that the team should say, well, we're going to deliberately try to lose the game because then we'll fit into this correlation. That would be wrong application of probability theory. And I see Ryan makes point, somebody who says that money is evil would find little agreement when someone has an object to this world. Yes, that's a very good point. But you see, what Mises is going to say is, okay, when you're dealing with ideology, you'll be able to come up with a ways people can agree, even if they have this very radical difference in worldview. Now, how can Mises say this? I mean, remember he said, okay, we have this, he's insisted that people have this radical difference in worldview, but he says, well, in ideology, you could come up with ways of resolving the disagreements. So you could say, but look, Mises, aren't you ignoring the fact that people disagree about ideology as well? It's not just different worldviews, but say if you take Marxists, Nazis, classical liberals, all sorts of other ideologies, they have very different opinions about what to do. So how can Mises say that unlike a situation with worldviews, people will be able to resolve their disputes about ideology? I don't know why someone always calls when I'm giving this class. I hope it's not the same person, but they probably do. It's probably either Wenzel or Kinsella. Yeah, that was one of the all-time great debates. I thought I enjoyed that one. But it's much more interesting than my class, I can assure you, but that isn't such a high standard, high bar to go by. Okay, so these groups have someone suggested that it's Obama on the red phone, he's going to change his policy. I say, well, if he's on the phone, I have one question for him. Where do you stand on IP? They each have these different opinions, but what Mises says in response is almost everybody favors material prosperity. So if that's right, if almost everybody favors material prosperity, then it's a factual matter what best promotes prosperity. And I see Garth is skeptical here. He says, I don't believe people who espouse Marx can be persuaded by economic utility. Well, see, I think you have a very good point, Garth, but it isn't quite what Mises is addressing. He's not saying that, in fact, Marxists are going to accept what he says. Probably they won't, but he's just saying he can show based on values that they profess that they should accept what he says, which is a little different point. So he's saying, well, look, all these ideologies give very different prescriptions on what to do. Marx says we should have a socialized economy, and the Nazis say we should get rid of all the Jews and have racial purity. Classical liberals say we should have a free market, but all of them want material prosperity, and it'll turn out that the classical liberal is right, and that's not a matter of a controversial value judgment. That's a straightforward factual matter. So that's the fundamental direction he's going. Now, you might object to him, and Mises saying everybody values material prosperity, but aren't there some people who don't? Aren't there ascetics? People who just go off and live by themselves, or people who don't value material prosperity at all? They just say, we should live a simple life. We shouldn't. You've probably heard people say, we spend too much on consumer goods. We should just get rid of those and just try to live simply. There are all sorts of writers. I've not got into tremendous trouble because I criticized a writer named Wendell Berry, who's a defender of certain kinds of agricultural production. He's popular in some paleoconservative circles. So I said he didn't know anything about economics, or at least not very much. And he had a lot of followers who attacked me for saying that. But you could say, well, aren't there people like him who just say material prosperity is overrated? So isn't Mises wrong? But there are some people who don't, in fact, a lot of people who don't value material prosperity. So Mises says, well, depends what you mean by ascetics. So if you take strict ascetics, people who don't value material prosperity at all, well, maybe there are such people. There aren't very many of them. And even if people who believe that, say, we're overemphasizing consumption or we should try to live a simple life, most of them are interested in material welfare to some extent. I think, say, example I gave, Wendell Berry is actually a pretty well-off farmer. So you'll very rarely find, according to Mises, people who just want to forget about material prosperity at all. So when he's saying certain policies will produce material prosperity, and this is a factual matter, then this is something, this point will have a grip on nearly everybody, because nearly everybody will be concerned with material prosperity. And it means that there aren't very many consistent ascetics, and if there are, they will not last long. Now, Simon says Rousseau wasn't interested in material prosperity. Well, he had different views on that. Remember, he wrote on economics in the encyclopedia, the French encyclopedia, so he did sometimes show some interest in material prosperity. Sometimes he does preach simplicity, but again, he would be in one of these groups, kind of what Mises would call not a pure ascetic. So Mises' point about how to retain material prosperity wouldn't just pass him by entirely. He would have some concern with it, although not as much as some others. Now, once we accept the point that practically everybody favors material prosperity, then we can then settle questions by argument. So remember what our problem was. Well, we start off with people have these different conflicting worldviews, and it seems like you can't settle you can't settle arguments between say one person is religious, the other person isn't. So how are you going to settle that? At least Mises thinks you can't. But he thinks when you're dealing with the ideologies, which is a matter of what you're supposed to do, he says most people will care about material prosperity. And then we can settle questions by argument. We can say somebody has a different ideology from classical liberal, and we can say, look, insofar as you favor material prosperity, you're just wrong. This doesn't involve rejecting your value judgments. It's just a matter of fact. And he points out also that most of the ideology, or all the ideologies that are popular ones in their propaganda, when they won't say, support us and you'll be very poor and have to sacrifice, they'll promote what they'll defend what they're promoting by saying, this will lead to prosperity. So he said, if you look at the major ideologies, they in fact are interested in prosperity. So what I said so far is Mises said that, everybody wants material prosperity, so it's a factual matter what will achieve that. But this, of course, leaves open, well, what exactly will achieve material prosperity? And what Mises says is that what is it supposed to be that everybody is supposed to acknowledge? It's that social cooperation is necessary for prosperity. Remember, this is what we've been talking about for most of this course, how people won't get anywhere just trying to produce by themselves. They have to cooperate with others and take advantage of specialization and division of labor. This is the key way to prosperity. And this point I was dealing with at the start, we talked about comparative advantage and absolute advantage. That's very relevant to this. So if you're trading with somebody else and you specialize in your comparative advantage and the other person does as well, you'll both be better off than if you try to produce everything by yourself. So that's a point. It doesn't matter what your political views are, what your ideology is, so long as you're concerned with prosperity, you should acknowledge this. And let's take the extreme case. Suppose someone's a Nazi. Now say the Nazi says, you're talking about social cooperation in the free market. This is just a liberal idea. What I care about as a Nazi is just expanding the power of Germany and getting rid of racial enemies. So what Mises says, look, what the Nazi said, he goes into this much more in his book, Omnipotent Government, which came out in 1944. He said they said they were in favor of material prosperity for the German people. What the Nazis said is Germany is overpopulated in its present territory, so in order for the German people to survive, they need access to raw materials and land in outside their territory, and to do that they'd have to conquer other countries, principally in Eastern Europe. So they said, if we can get living space, Lebensraum, in these other areas, then we can get, this will help the process, we'll be able to end the suffering of the German people, we'll be able to get more prosperity. So what Mises is saying, one could say to the Nazis, not that they listen to it, but we can say to them, look, what you're proposing won't get you the prosperity you're supposed to be seeking. The way to get that would be to have a free market and trade with other people. And he suggests that if people don't realize this, then the only way they could oppose the Nazis is just try to stop them by force from getting what they want. But he thinks that people in the other European countries hadn't fully adopted free market policies, they were in a good position to combat what the Nazis were saying, because a lot of those countries were trying to seek economic self-sufficiency and rejecting trade. So the Nazis were just applying the same policies more consistently than these other parties. But he said to really oppose the Nazis, then you'd have to show that their aim, material prosperity, could be attained not by their policies, but rather by the free market. Now, there are some people, Mises makes a more general point about theories other than this point about prosperity. He said there are some people who think that inconsistent theories are in some respects good. Why is that? Well, if you've got an inconsistent theory, then it would prevent a bad idea from being fully carried out. Now, let's suppose, what would be an example? Let's suppose somebody holds some view of racial superiority, thinks, well, the white race is really the master race and really entitled to dominate other races, somewhat like the Nazis. But the person also thinks that everybody, even people in the inferior races, have certain rights that have to be respected. So I might say, well, those ideas aren't perfectly consistent, but it's still a good idea that the person has that view, because then he won't act fully on his bad idea that the one of the racial superiority. His inconsistency will prevent him from fully carrying out the plans that he had. I mean, similarly, just like this criticism I was mentioning that Mises had of some of the opposition to the Nazis. Some of the opponents of Nazism believed in economic self-sufficiency, but because they were also influenced by certain more liberal ideas, they didn't favor ending international trade altogether, replacing it with some kind of completely state-controlled system where the state was regulating everything. So isn't it a good thing that their theory was inconsistent? But Mises doesn't accept that. He doesn't deny that it might be good that people didn't carry out their bad ideas fully, but he thinks a good theory really should be consistent. A good theory is one, not one where the errors in the theory kind of cancel each other out. But a good theory is one that's right, the whole theory's right, and then at least that's better than one that's inconsistent but avoids certain bad consequences. It's better to have your theory be completely right if you can get it that way. And in developing this point that he made before, that some of the more extreme theories are really extending ideas that are very popular. He has a brief discussion of so-called monetary cranks. Now, monetary crank, as he's using the term, we could consider kind of an extreme inflationist who, the monetary crank will have a doctrine like this. People are being held down, or they're not prosperous, because the bankers are artificially keeping the money supply low and interest rates high, because that will be to their advantage. If we could free ourselves from what the Nazi Party program called the tyranny of interest, then we'd be all right. We just have to end the tyranny of interest, and then people could get money much more easily. Businesses would be able to borrow money from the banks instead of now small businesses are crowded out because the monopoly banks won't lend to them. Now you find those ideas, you'll find some, even today, there's some so-called left libertarians who will make comments like that, not all of them. But this is kind of the characteristic view of the monetary crank, is that by inflation and lowering or eliminating interest is the way to prosperity. So Mises says here, well, that isn't much different actually from doctrines that are very much in the mainstream. For example, the Keynesians think that increasing spending is the way out of a depression, and they talk about liquidity traps and interest rates being too high. So Mises says the monetary cranks are really just developing ideas popular in mainstream economics. You see, it's a quite similar point, the one he just made about the Nazis, where he said, well, the other countries in Europe were very much taken by the false view that a nation should be economically self-sufficient, and that nations really can develop by taking things from other countries. They need space for raw materials. They should just conquer the other countries and expel or kill the native population, and just because what they're interested in is helping their own people. So Mises says, well, the Nazis just took those views to an extreme and carried them out more consistently, and to reject them in a consistent way, you would have to embrace classical liberalism. So he's making a similar point here about the monetary cranks, and saying the monetary cranks just take very seriously and develop fully ideas that are very popular in mainstream economics. And he uses this point about the similarity between so-called extreme views and more mainstream views. We've seen this again in both this monetary cranks and also the ones about the Nazis. He uses this to express some doubt about criticism of people for so-called lunatic ideas. When he was writing, remember, Human Action came out in 1949, during World War II, there was a theory that was popular in some circles that the reasons the Nazis had come to power was there was some kind of sickness in the mental sickness among the German people, or some of the German people. There was some kind of psychological aberrations that accounted for the Nazis. So this would account for their affinity for lunatic ideas, namely the Nazi ideas. And Mises here, he's somewhat like Thomas Sosley, the libertarian psychiatrist who wrote later. He said, there isn't a clear criterion for craziness. And what exactly is a crazy idea? As he said earlier, the so-called crazy ideas are really just developing ideas that are very much not considered crazy. So he says that if you want to criticize someone, some ideas, it isn't a good strategy or good policy just to say, well, this person is a lunatic. I mean, but what you have to do, because there isn't a clear criterion for separating so-called lunatics from others, but instead we should rely on economics. We should say, look, you say you want to get material prosperity, but what you're proposing won't lead to that. In fact, to get what you say you want, you should favor the free market. I think that will end the lecture now. Then we can discuss, we can have the rest time for questions, comments, discussion of the IP, when Zell can sell a debate, anything you'd like. Okay. Let's see, did anybody have any questions that I missed? Now Ryan asked, what were Mises' views on IP? Well, he doesn't really say an enormous amount about the subject. He suggests that there's some dispute among economists about whether patents promote innovation or not. But remember, he's a utilitarian, so he pretty much takes it as a matter, really, of it's up to the people to decide what they want to do. He doesn't think there's any view that they have to adopt. I mean, he wouldn't take a view something like, we can come up with some argument that you must be opposed to IP on some kind of grounds, the nature of property rights, or anything like that. I mean, he would just say it's a matter of convenience. And Travis says, Topic still divides libertarian. Yes, yes, it seems to generate a lot of action. Now John says, can I sell this lecture or is it protected? The answer to that is yes. Nobody laughed at that. I didn't say, John, I didn't say you could sell this lecture. I said, yes, it's either the case that you can sell this lecture or it's protected. That was supposed to be the joke. So I'm endorsing your disjunction, but I'm not saying which part is correct. Now, Malcolm says, let's see, has anyone made the argument the final solution was born out of economic necessity for the Nazis to continue the war? Whether it was economically efficient to wage war is a different question. Why does he need a solution? Yes, there have been people who thought just that. They say, I think there was a German historian, Goetz Ali, who wrote on that, who said, well, for the Nazi view was, here are all these Jews around, we'll have to devote resources to feed them, and we don't want to do that, so then we have to get rid of them. I mean, that isn't the dominant view, but I mean, people have suggested that. Malcolm said, what were Rothbard's views on Mises' views regarding worldview, how did his views compare? Well, I think Rothbard, I think, would have been more inclined than Mises to think that you can attain truth about some of the philosophical issues. Also, Mises tend to think once you're dealing with something that's transcendent, then there's really nothing much you can say about it. But I don't think Rothbard would agree with that. And then Cam says, too late, I just posted on Craigslist. Well, Yeah, I just posted your new book on Craigslist also. Okay. Now, Ryan says the vampire economy goes into Nazi economics in depth. Yes, I think that is a very good book. I think you're right to recommend it. Now, Malcolm has a quotation from Mises, what were the plans by Solvay? I could only find information on a scientific discovery in Solvay conference. Well, I'd have to look that up, actually. I assume he had some inflationist views also. Now, it's possible, if one hesitates to impute error to Mises, but possibly he was thinking perhaps of Frederick Soddy, S-O-D-D-Y, was a leading British chemist who was somewhat of a monetary crank. Maybe he shouldn't have said Solvay, but I'd have to look that up. And John says, all men are created equal. Did the founding fathers not understand the law of association? Well, remember, John, we dealt with that a little bit last time. When you say all men are created equal, that's just a statement of how people ought to be treated. It isn't a claim about people's biological abilities. Did Mises or Rothbard ever discuss how they went out the writing process or magnum opuses? How do they frame their point of view in the writing process? I don't think they did. I think you're right, it might be very useful if they'd done that, but I don't think they really wrote much about how they organized their works or how they did that. I think you're right, it would be good to know that, but John says they married the typist. Rothbard did marry someone who typed his work. Now, Malcolm says, I just finished reading Rothbard's Wall Street Banks and American Foreign Policy. Is anyone in the follow-up book who has a breadth of knowledge to do so at this point? Did Rothbard or anyone using Rothbardian analysis ever write about the history of philanthropy, reforms, and how they're connected, controlled by banking industry? The same question, but for journalism and publishing. Well, there are quite a few questions there. I don't think anyone's done such a follow-up book, I suppose. Who would have the knowledge to do it? Well, maybe Joe Salerno or Hans Hoppe. I suppose there might be various people who could do it. And I don't know of anyone who's written about history of philanthropy and how they're connected, controlled by banking industry. There was, in the 1950s, there was a group called the Rees Committee in the House of Representatives, headed by B. Carroll Rees of Tennessee, who investigated various philanthropic foundations. That's Rees, R-E-E-C-E. There was a book by Rene Wormser, Wormser, called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, that went into that. And on journalism and publishing, I don't know offhand. So according to Mises, Rothbard's idea that ethics is based on natural law and self-ownership wouldn't be part of his worldview and its ideology. No, because it would be part, that would be in ethics. You see, that's part of ethics, so that would be telling you, it would be directed toward action. It would be, you know, if you have, when Mises, when Rothbard says people are self-owners, that isn't just kind of a interesting fact about people. He's using that as a guide. That's a guide to how people can decide property claims and various other claims. So that would be part of ideology, according to Mises. Gates. Somebody's had Malcolm has a reference to the Rees Committee. Good. Would Mises classify Rand's view of natural laws as theocratic? I don't think he would. I mean, she wouldn't be claiming she has some kind of direct access to the way history's going, but I think he just thinks that her views were mistaken, but I don't think he'd call her theocratic. Oh, that was fast. They found Rene Wurmser and Dean Carol Reese. That was fast. In the old days before computers, people wouldn't have been able to do that. That's impressive. Now, Cam says, can you speak of where class analysis originated and how Marx took his class analysis from the classical liberals? Well, Ralph Rako has some good papers on that Journal of Libertarian Studies. Actually, notes that class analysis really got started with the French classical liberals like Charles Comte, C-O-M-T-E, Charles Dunoyer, D-U-N-O-Y-E-R, and what they emphasized is that there are various groups that use the state, which is in the means of extracting resources from people by force to advance their aims. And Marx really took over some of his ideas from them, from other historians like Augustin Thierry, T-H-I-E-R-R-Y. So they're really kind of a classical liberal views, but he took them over. So it was more the, and although in some of his works, like the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, he had the same view of the state as a way of extracting resources from some people to benefit others. In most of his class analysis, it was more emphasizing the economic class rather than its connection with the state. Now, Simon said, Mises asserts extermination and enslavement of others is for them not the ultimate end. There are certainly groups that pursue this as an ultimate end, for example, political ponerology. Now, studies this, I'm not familiar with ponerology. What was Mises being naive? Well, I think what Mises might say there is if somebody said, well, I just like killing people of a certain group, I think this group is evil and they've got to be gotten rid of, he would say, look, but they also say they favor material prosperity. Would they be willing to pursue this ultimate end of getting rid of the other people if it would be harmful to material prosperity? So I think that's what he might say. What do you think of G. Edward Griffin's Creature from Jekyll Island? Is there anything you would disagree with the book? Is there any review of it? I think it has been reviewed at the Mises Institute. I'm not remembering exactly who did it. As far as I remember, it was a quite good book. I mean, I think he was influenced by Rothbard on the nature of the Federal Reserve System. I think that is a book that's worth reading. Yeah, he was, G. Edward Griffin has been around for a long time. I think he was associated with the John Birch Society for some time. Did Mises talk about more about this psychiatry question or comment on Saas? Did Saas comment on Mises and Rothbard and how they views affect each other? Well, Saas has a book, I reviewed it, where I think he does comment on Mises and Rothbard. Mises didn't discuss psychiatry in detail. He was quite interested in Freud, though, and he knew Freud, and he makes remarks in Human Action from time to time about psychoanalysis, but he doesn't really say that much about it, but he was interested in. But I don't think he pursued in detail any view of mental illness the way Saas did, but I thought the remarks that I mentioned in the lecture gave were somewhat suggestive, perhaps, of a Saasian strain. Now, Colin said, Saas seemed to doubt Freud in general. Yes, I think Saas quotes the Austrian journalist Karl Kraus, human writer, saying psychoanalysis is a disease for which it pretends to be the cure. Malcolm has a number of questions about Eisenhower, but I don't know the answer to that. You're considering Eisenhower's connection with various industrial groups and what was behind the military-industrial complex speech. I think Robert Higgs would be a good one to read on the military-industrial speech. I think he has an essay on it, but I don't know specifics on why Eisenhower wrote that speech. I think there was a particular liberal Republican advisor whose name is escaping me who was responsible for that speech, but I don't really know about his connections with banking. Now, Ryan said, could extreme patriotism be a form of Stockholm syndrome? Well, especially, I suppose, with extreme Swedish patriotism. Yes, Brian says, I think we talked about etatism in omnipotent government. Yes, etatism, just in French, would mean statism. It's just kind of any kind of collectivism or support of the state. Oh, Cam has a reference to Higgs. Yes, Cam, you're very good at coming up with fast references. That's very impressive. You'll go far. Colin says, do you think it's fair to say me saying crazy not definable does not really exist? I think he's more or less saying what he's really concerned with is not to deny that there are people in the conventional sense who would call crazy people suffering from various psychiatric complaints. I don't think he's really committing himself to a Thomas Sowell's line on that. But what he is saying is he's doubtful about attempts to characterize political doctrines as crazy or lunatic, and there his argument is that they're not that different from views that aren't considered lunatic. And you can see from what I talked about in the lecture why he's going to take that position, because if you say some view is crazy, then you can't really argue with it, because then you can just say, well, you know, this guy's a lunatic, what am I going to do? But if the view isn't crazy, then Mises can apply his usual suggestion. He says, well, this crazy view wants monetary prosperity too, wants economic prosperity too, so then you could ask, you could say, even for the crazy view, the free market is social cooperation, the free market is the way to achieve that. So when I said, then there's some jokes about Cam, a name like Cam, where you'd expect them to be on in a flash. And you have an overdeveloped sense of humor. Well, I'm left in the dark room on that. Now, Malcolm says, do you mind if I ask what your PhD thesis is on? What attracted you to study intellectual history? No, I don't mind if you ask that. My thesis was on Jean Baudin's political philosophy. And what attracted me? Well, I just thought it seemed like an interesting topic to write on. It seemed fairly straightforward at the time. You know, I mean, it's hard to say. I guess I just thought it seemed like an interesting subject, so I went into it. Now here's one. What did Robert think the Mises got wrong in Human Action, if anything? What did current Austrians think the Mises got wrong in Human Action, if anything? And Travis says natural rights. Well, I mean, Rothbard didn't agree with the ethical views Mises expressed, the utilitarianism, but I think what he had a somewhat different view of economic propositions. He thought more economic propositions rather than be emphasizing their a priori, in the sense their developments of a priori categories of the mind. Rothbard thought they were necessary connections in the world, that we can get these concepts by deriving from experience, but we can get real necessities from experience. Ryan says laws of reality rather than laws of thought. Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. Gar says, I still cannot see ethics in utilitarians. Well, you see, utilitarianism, I mean, it's standardly taken, and it is an ethical theory in the sense it's saying you ought to do that action which will, of the alternatives available to you, promote overall happiness at least as much as any alternative. I mean, that seems to be about ethics. Why would you think it wouldn't be? I'm just telling you what you ought to do. The same as Mills. Well, I mean, there's differences between Mises' utilitarianism and is somewhat different from that of either James Mill or John Stuart Mill, but they would, all of them would be, I think, ethical systems. At least I'm not seeing why not. Now, how would he respond to it, saying that's just ends justifying the means? I think what he would, I think what Mises would say there probably is, it is your goals that determine whether a means is suitable or justified. See, the expression the end justifies the means sometimes has the meaning it's all right to do very bad things like kill people if you have a sufficiently important end. And he certainly wouldn't be committed to thinking that, but I think he would be thinking that you evaluate means by whether they're suitable to achieve the ends that they're designed to do. That's what he's doing in his criticism of these various ideologies. But that doesn't commit him to say it's sometimes all right to do what's ordinarily taken to be very bad things if you have a sufficiently good end. I think there's somewhat of an ambiguity in this phrase. The end justifies the mean, whereas in one case it's somewhat innocuous, even if not necessarily true. In the other sense, it would be kind of a bad idea or something that we wouldn't want to attribute to people. Has anyone written a good paper on how utilitarianism affects the Austrian school, where it divides or causes divide the Austrian school itself? Well, that's a very interesting topic for a paper. I think Leland Jaeger has written defenses of utilitarianism in criticism of those opposed to it, but I don't know of anyone who's done kind of a comprehensive study of utilitarianism and the Austrian school. That's a very interesting question. Now, John says, does originary interest exist because ends have a higher value than means? Well, I think Guido Holtzmann has suggested such a view, but I would tend not to go along with that. I think interest is just because people value attaining something in the present more than in the future, but I don't really see why Guido would hold this particular view. I think I suppose he's thinking, well, there's some, at least some conceptually, some kind of time gap between the ends and means, that there wouldn't have to be. I mean, you could have something that's a means to achieve a certain end simultaneously, like, say, you have various parts of a watch or interacting to attain the end of something that tells the time, but I don't think you'd have to hold that all the parts of the watch are somehow combined in the right way or worth less than the watch because the watch is the means. Indra should be independent of time, but not of action. Well, I think, no, I think, I don't think Indra should be, is, originary interest is, in the Zestian view, a phenomenon involving action in time, but I mean, I don't think that if you're concerned with simultaneous action, I don't think the question of interest would be involved. Now, Mises wrote, for political reasons, people want to reject Malthusian law. What were the political reasons behind this rejection? Well, I'm not sure. Oh, I think one thing he had in mind there was that there were, according to the Malthusian principle, population growth, if there were increases in wage rates, then population would expand and to such a point that the wages would then fall again. So people who favored policies to increase wage rates wouldn't be too sympathetic to that. They'd say, well, you know, we want to increase wages and we don't like this view that this, if we do that, that won't help workers. I think he's thinking kind of a somewhat socialistic or interventionist views would oppose Malthus on this point. Remember, Malthus wrote explicitly he was writing against the views of William Godwin, who was an anarchist writer who kind of thought that... now, Kinsella and Roderick Long are taking unconventional views on interest rates. I'm not familiar with Kinsella's view. I know Roderick gave a paper at the recent conference where he said, well, on a time transfer... I mean, on title transfer theory of property, there might be some limits on interest because but I thought there are some problems with his view, so I gave an objection. He's working on that now. See, he thought something like this. He said, well, if, say, you loan me $1,000, so if on a title transfer, I can't transfer you now $1,000 because I, by hypothesis, I'm free to spend the money. So what I promise to pay you $1,000 plus interest, but if I don't do that, you can just sue me for damages and not for not returning your money. You could get, in addition to the $1,000, you might get damages for the money, for the time you hadn't been able to spend the money, but that might limit the amount of interest. So what I contend is, no, you can transfer to the person, at least in most cases, say you borrowed $1,000 and you agreed to pay $100, you would be transferring now $1,100 in of your assets payable a year from now, and you do have that, because most people, when they make loans, they do have more than the amount of the loan in their total assets. They just don't want to sell off their assets. That's why they want the money. So on my objection, you would be able to make, you wouldn't be able to limit interest in the way he wanted. And now, wait, here's Malcolm has, I think, the fundamental mistake in Marxist social democracy, the man is created equal. Would you say this is their fundamental mistake? Well, I'm not sure in what sense they would all be committed to thinking that people are equal. I mean, it might be And it, Ryan points out, even if people were creating equal socials, not be efficient. That's a good point. But on the question, I'm not sure in what sense they think people are equal, whether that's a fundamental mistake in those doctrines. That isn't a very good answer, but I'd have to see in more detail. Now, John says, would you say originary interest equates price over different times to reflect differences in value as a result of time preference? Yeah, I would say it's discounting the value. It's taking what you're doing in interest is you have the same good, so you wouldn't have different values for the same good. It's always the same value for a particular good because it's the identical good, but you discount the value of the good when it's not available now. The same good is worth less to you in the future than it is now, but it's always the same good, so there aren't differences in value of the good. It's differences in the time at which the good is available. And Travis has a comment that they're trying to achieve material equality, because that would be true at least of some kinds of socialism, not necessarily democracy, though. Now, Colin said, did I speak at this year's AERC? Yes, I was in the panel that Paul Gottfried had on war and anti-war. I gave a short talk on anti-war writers from William Graham Sumner to Murray Rothbard. It was just about 20 minutes. And I was also the chairman of a different session. Malcolm says, in the movie Lincoln, the character Tommy Lee Jones speaks stating equality before the law. Oh, yes, I haven't seen that movie yet. It's probably not as good as the Wenzel Kinsella debate, but you know, maybe it's worth seeing anyway. I wish they'd had that debate on video as well as audio. That would have been even better. Lincoln versus Zombies. Yes, that would be a good movie too. Now, John says, not as preferred or future use, then it's different only due to time value. Yes, it's due to, yes, that people prefer goods in the present to the future, the near future to the far future, yes. Yes, that's right, yes. Now, Colin says, what is your view of the debate last night, honest? I don't want to get into that. It would be too controversial. I think it's much more, I would say this, it's much more difficult to come up with good arguments on this subject than many people think, but I'm not going to go into detail. Now, Malcolm says, any idea on choosing the next course between the action? Well, I don't know. I think they have me. The next two courses I'm giving more introductory economics courses on capitalism and broken capitalism that are based on readings from Mises and Henry Hazlitt, but not human action. They'll be on more elementary level, so those might be interesting in case you're now, Garth, is there anywhere specific I can read Mises' critique of natural rights? Well, just look up writes in the Index of Human Action, you'll see, has some discussions of it. Now, John says, can you tell me when the dollar will have zero value? No, I hope it isn't for a long time. Well, okay, I guess we're out of time now before the dollar plunged to zero at any rate. So thanks very much for coming, and I hope we'll see you all next week. Bye, everybody.